This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Welcome to the U.S. House of Representatives candidate debate, live in VPR's Stetson Studio One. This campaign season, VPR and Vermont PBS are teaming up for a series of debates that are broadcast live on both the radio and on television. We're hearing from candidates for statewide and federal office in an effort to help you make informed choices when you go out to vote on November 6th. Today's debate is with the two major party candidates for Vermont's lone seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, incumbent Democratic Representative Peter Welch of Norwich, who is seeking a seventh term in the House, and Republican challenger Anya Tino of West Charleston, who works as a sales representative for the Newport Daily Express. It's a pleasure to have both of you with us today for this debate.
Pleasure to be here.
Let me tell you a little bit about the format of the debate, and we're using this throughout all of our campaign 2018 debates. In the first segment, I'll be asking you a common question, and I'll give a chance for both of you to respond to that. In the second segment of the debate, you'll have an opportunity to ask one another questions, and that's always a fascinating part of the debate for all of us. And then we'll turn to a series of questions that have been submitted by Vermonters. If we have time at the end, we'll have a quick lightning round, and that is really short, 10, 15 seconds for each answer. And we'll conclude our program with one-minute closing statements from each candidate. So let's get right into the questions here, and I'm hoping that you'll limit your answers to 60 seconds. I may ask a brief follow-up, and we'll start with Peter Welch. The role of a congressperson is to represent your constituents, represent Vermonters, but also to be part of a governing body that helps control the direction of the country. So what's the right balance between doing what's best solely for Vermonters, for your constituents, or thinking of yourself as somebody who's working to the betterment of the United States?
Well, two things. Number one, I define my job as being responsible to do everything I can to promote policies in Washington that help Vermonters succeed back home. That's number one. Number two, I think we're all in it together. And I think good policies that help Vermonters, trying to bring down the costs that are really afflicting the middle class, increase wages that have been stagnant, attacking climate change, having a positive role in the world, that's good for Vermont. I think it's good for the nation. We are all in it together.
But there are policies that are going to be better for Vermont than for other states, or better for rural states than urban, or northern states than southern. So how do you think about your decisions when it comes to that kind of
policy? Well, my first allegiance is to Vermont. So there's areas like agriculture. It's really tough for Vermont dairy. And with Senator Leahy and Senator Sanders, we're doing everything we can to help Vermont dairy. Broadband build-out is essential to rebuild our rural economy. And I've worked hard to bring money to Vermont to expand the reach of broadband. But what I find is that in Congress, you have to build coalitions. So, for instance, I created the Rural Caucus in the Energy and Commerce Committee, and I work with a lot of Republicans and Democrats where they're not Vermont, but the problems that their constituents face are very similar to Vermont. And I work with them to try to do things that, yes, will be very good for Vermont, but oftentimes it's going to be good for other folks who are similarly situated.
Similarly, you get a lot of pressure from party leaders when you're in Washington. How often do you think about Vermonters as a whole, some of whom haven't voted for you, but even ticket splitters who do, versus what your party wants you to do?
Vermonters come first. And I'll give you an example. When we had the Tropical Storm Irene, and it devastated our infrastructure, we had to lift the cap of $100 million to rebuild what was devastating across our state. There were political fights between Pelosi and Cantor. And I remember Pelosi approached me to stick with the Democrats when I said, absolutely not. I'm working with Cantor for Vermont. So Vermont has to come first.
Anya Tino, what about for you? How do you think about the balance of needing to do what's right for Vermonters and what's right for the country as a whole when those two things might differ?
I think in general, what's right is right. If it's good for Vermont, it's most likely going to be good for the nation. When things favor us a little more than other states, obviously Vermont would come first. But right is right. If we are working towards policies that are good for our citizens in this state, then most likely they would be good for citizens in other states. There is the rural component. A lot of the rural states we would need to partner with, perhaps, and see how we could better promote agriculture across the board. And for the urban states, we do have an urban population as well. So I think that when you focus on the betterment of people, it's the betterment of people everywhere.
So does that mean you're not really differentiating between what's good for Vermonters and what's good for the country? You think of them as the same thing?
In some instances, there would be a differentiation between the state and the country, but for the most part, we are American citizens, and what's good for America is good for us.
What about when it comes to party dynamics, and you think about what might be best for Vermont versus what your party may be pressuring you to do?
I think that it's important to have an open mind about things. When you're talking party, there's always that, I'm sure Mr. Welsh can agree, there's always that pressure to stick with your party, but you have to vote according to your conscience, and you have to make the decision that you know that your constituents will benefit best from.
You don't have a voting record yet, so no. Would we see at the end of your first term that you had not just voted party line? Would there be votes that you bucked the party trend on?
You will see that I made the decision that I felt was best for everyone involved.
Let's tackle another topic. Dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a columnist for The Washington Post, disappeared 2 weeks ago. He's alleged to have been killed and dismembered at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, where he was last seen on October 2nd. Saudi Arabia has officially denied that he died at the consulate, but the New York Times has reported that officials may be preparing to state that he was killed there in an interrogation gone wrong. What should the U.S. reaction be to Khashoggi's murder or apparent murder? Anya Tino?
I think that what has happened to this journalist is a sign of the oppression that other countries have towards the media. And I think that we're fortunate in this country that we don't have such oppression. Our reaction does need to be strong. Saudi Arabia has always been an ally in the course of fighting terrorism. We have good relations with them in general, but we cannot allow ourselves to be biased towards them in this instant. We must take the same approach that we would take with any other country to address this humanitarian crisis.
If it is found to be true that he was killed inside the Saudi Arabian consulate, what specific action should the United States take? Should it cancel arms deals with Saudi Arabia?
I'm sure that that would be looked into to see what action was appropriate at the time, what the spectrum of knowledge was, who was involved, what form of punishment needs to be meted out to that, if there's sanctions, possibly armament differences. All of those things will be looked at. That is something that we'll have to wait for the investigation to be concluded to decide the severity of what we will do.
You'd be open to that, though?
Yes.
Peter Welch?
Well, first of all, the evidence that we have indicates pretty clearly that Khashoggi was murdered, and it was done by the Saudis, and all of the evidence indicates that the people who came, 15 Saudis flown in on the day of the event, flown out on the day of the event, were all very close to their leader, Osama bin Salman. So that's appalling. Second, President Trump appears not to be acknowledging that, or even pointing the finger of responsibility there, but parroting the denials of the king. Third, this is extraordinarily devastating. If this goes unpunished and unreacted to, it's a embrace of autocratic power to the point of killing people and a journalist, because Khashoggi's crime from the Saudi Arabian perspective was that he was critical of the royal family. So fourth, I do think we have to take action, and I think we have to do it with our allies. Number one, we should suspend arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and I'm sponsoring a bill to do that.
Now. We should do that now.
Yes, we should. And the other thing is that we should be really pulling back from Saudi Arabia with respect to what they're doing in Yemen, because it is a bombing campaign that is leading to the most devastating humanitarian suffering that is going on in the region at this time. So we've got to take, I think, strong action where we show that the use of violence as a political tactic is not acceptable under any circumstances.
Are you satisfied with President Trump's response so far? He has sent, I think, Mike Pompeo there immediately to Saudi Arabia to look into this?
I'm not at all, because what he's done is also indicated that he's accepting at face value the denial by the king.
I would like to say that Mr. Trump has come out and said that this is unacceptable. He has sent Mike Pompeo there to look into it. And I think that we do need an investigation before we make drastic decisions in regards to Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of that we have at stake in the area, in the region. And we need to proceed cautiously and yet not allow ourselves or this humanitarian crisis to go unpunished.
If the president says, look, the king of Saudi Arabia says he didn't know about it. It wasn't him. Then do we leave it at that? Do we let that be
the evidence
determining factor?
Will lead us to what we need to know. As he was stating, there are people with ties to this person. And once we discover how closely that was, the chances that he did know about it are pretty good. Most things in those countries are known about.
You know, what worries me is that there's a inclination on the part of President Trump to cozy up to autocrats. He's very cozy with Putin. He validated Putin's denial of interfering in the election, despite the fact that every single one of our intelligence agencies said there was significant Russian involvement. He praises the North Korean leader. He's saying, with respect to cutting off arms sales, that he doesn't want to lose the money. I mean, that's literally what he said. So I have real skepticism that there's an on-the-level approach from Donald Trump to get to the bottom of this.
Let's talk about immigration. If you were building a new U.S. immigration system from scratch, what would it look like? So philosophically and practically, how would it look different from what we have today? Peter Welch?
Well, I'd pass the Senate bill. You know, the United States Senate a few years ago, on a bipartisan basis, people like Senator McCain and Senator Leahy and voted for a comprehensive immigration bill. And it addressed the central components. We need border security. They beefed up border security. It provided a path to citizenship for people who are here without legal status. And it was a tough one. They had to make sure they were square with the law, paid all their taxes, and there was no amnesty. And it provided status for the dreamers, so-called, the folks, the kids who were brought here by their parents when they were 4 or 5 years old, had nothing to do with the circumstances by which they came here, are oftentimes serving in the military as first responders. We have a medical student, Juan Conde, who's at the University of Vermont. Those folks are real contributors, and they were provided with legal status. The frustration I've had is that we have been denied an opportunity to even vote on a immigration bill, a comprehensive immigration bill in the House. So there's an answer to this. We just have to have an opportunity to vote on comprehensive immigration reform.
So you've gotten into some of the specifics right away based on the system that we have that I think everybody agrees needs some tweaks or maybe some wholesale fixes. What's your philosophical approach to immigration? Do you believe that this should be a country that is welcoming to many people of other countries? Should we have borders that are perhaps more closed?
We should definitely be welcoming, and our borders should be secure, not closed. We want to have legal immigration. But this country has always relied on the contributions that immigrants have provided. And a confident, by the way, people come to this country oftentimes bring real benefits. So, yes, I believe that we should have secure borders, but we should be more receptive to immigrants. I also think it's really upsetting to me that with respect to the number of people that are seeking asylum, the Trump administration is closing that down as opposed to opening it up some more, including, by the way, some citizens of Iraq and Afghanistan who served as interpreters for our military and put themselves in harm's way and who are in great jeopardy unless we allow them back to come into the U.S.
Anya Tinio, what's your approach?
Well, in answer to the original question about building one from scratch, I think that we could use to streamline our process to citizenship. It's a very time-consuming and cumbersome process. And if we looked at that and found how we could safely vet these people in less time and make it a more, like I said, streamlined proposition to get there, I think that we would have less trouble with illegal immigration.
Why?
Because I think that some people feel that the time constraints aren't conducive to the need of them to leave their country. Now, we have to stop legal immigration. We have to know who's in our country. We have to have a strong stance on this and strong laws against it. And we cannot allow what has been going on to continue. But in the end, we do need to welcome citizens from other countries to become productive citizens here and to be productive members of our society. So that was how I would look at starting it from scratch. As far as tweaking the one that we have currently, I think that we definitely need stronger immigration laws, and we need to look at the DACA recipients and so forth to see how we're going to move forward with that. Frankly, I think they should have been working on citizenship since they first got the news instead of protesting in the streets. But That's
since who got which news?
The DACA, the Dreamers.
Since they got what news?
The news that they were going to be looked at for not being legally in this country. They should have been working on citizenship from day one.
Do you mean since President Trump changed the Obama administration policy?
Yes.
Okay.
When they got the news that this was no longer the acceptable practice.
Then they should have been doing what?
They should have been working towards citizenship.
How can the DACA recipients work towards citizenship?
There is a path to citizenship. They needed to apply for it, and President Trump offered that. He pointed out that they needed to come and apply for citizenship and to come forth. And as I said, as long as they're productive members of society, we need to welcome immigrants. This country was built on immigrants. My family comes from immigrants, yours and yours. You'd have to be 100% Native American not to have an immigrant in your family tree somewhere. So we have always provided the landscape where people could come and build their dreams, and I'm all for that. We just need to do it with safety for our country in mind.
Would you like to see a border wall constructed across the entire border between the U.S. and Mexico?
I am a proponent of the border wall. I think that it's important to have strong borders, not necessarily closed borders, but strong borders.
A contentious version. We're going to give you a chance to talk to each other, and this may be an issue that comes up in conversation when you ask questions of each other. I want to talk a little bit about agricultural policy and the Farm Bill. There was a fairly contentious version of the 2018 Farm Bill that narrowly passed in the House in June. Representative Welch did not vote for it. Mm-hmm. Candidate Tino said she would have voted for it. What specifically was in that bill that influenced your stance, and what changes would you want to see in the final bill? Anya Tino?
I would like to see that the final bill provided comprehensive reform for the milk production prices. We need to protect our farmers. We need to make it viable for them to farm and bring more people into it. And we need to correct some of the fundamental flaws that are causing this problem. I think that we're moving in the right direction with tariffs and trades and the New Deal with Canada is definitely a benefit, as well as Mexico. So I think all of those things are moving in the right direction. In the interim, we do need to have the milk protection in place for farmers so that they do not continue to leave or go out of business at the rapid rate that they have been.
So do you support pretty significant government intervention in milk pricing and milk purchasing in order to support dairy farmers?
No, I believe that smaller government is the answer to most of our problems. I do think that since the government has been involved so much currently, we do need to work towards correcting what has been broken. But moving out of it is ultimately what we want to do. We want it to be self-sustaining without a lot of government help.
Do you think the agricultural policy that we pursue in the Farm Bill should be decoupled from some of the supplemental nutrition programs that are also included in the Farm Bill, like SNAP and WIC, you know, social safety net programs that are not directly tied to agricultural production?
I think that those benefits are placed in that bill to have interest placed upon it by many of the people that would be voting from a more urban area. It draws attention to the bill, and it drums up support, if you will, from areas that don't necessarily have an agricultural base, and that's why those are there. So I'm not necessarily a proponent of removing them.
Even though they often cause a stumbling block for actual passage of the Farm Bill.
Sometimes, but I think that we need to come together on what we're going to do to correct those programs as well. There's definitely widespread abuse that needs to be addressed.
Peter Welch, let me ask you that first question is, what influenced your stance on deciding to vote against the 2018 Farm Bill, and what would you like to see in the final version?
It was a really bad bill that Paul Ryan put forward largely as a way to try to save money to help pay for the deficit created by the tax cut. And his target in the Farm Bill were the nutrition programs, the programs that allow our kids who are from lower-income families to get a square meal at school, sometimes breakfast, sometimes lunch, and sometimes after-school meals. There was $23 billion that was cut out of the nutrition program, and that was going to affect about a million people, most of them kids, veterans, and disabled people. And to your other point, should we keep the nutrition program as part of the overall farm bill? I think we should. I mean, a couple of things. Number one, farmers are pretty proud that they feed America. And they've been proud that they have contributed to the nutrition programs. And then the other components in there does create an alliance with the various components of people that are affected by the Farm Bill. So I thought it was really totally unfortunate and really outrageous that the Farm Bill was used as a way to take hot lunch away from kids in order to help pay for the deficit created by the tax cut.
But you don't want to see those decoupled. You do want to see SNAP, WIC, other supplemental food programs, and other programs that are not quite tied to agricultural production still included in the Farm Bill. Is that because...
I do.
You know, you see them as feeding America, or because there needs to be a place for them?
I see it as feeding America. And farmers love the fact that without them, we wouldn't eat. And they're proud of that, and rightly should be. And the coalition that you create with some urban interests that don't necessarily appreciate what farmers do and what rural America does is a way of helping get us the votes that we need in order to pass a Farm Bill. And it's worked for us pretty well. This is the first time we haven't been able to get that Farm Bill done.
Do you also agree that the government should mostly be out of the dairy industry and milk pricing?
The government's got to play a role in agriculture. And the reason is that it's a different kind of market. And we saw this in the Depression when we had extreme weather events and the price that farmers got for their products collapsed. And farmers have to be able to stay in business through the tough times in order to be able to be there in the tough times. So there's got to be some government role that alleviates the wild swings. Now, it can be a minimal role. Like, for instance, the biggest crisis we have in dairy right now is the low price. And in fact, the low price below the cost of production plunged $1.20 when the president implemented his tariffs. And what I'd like to see us do is have some type of supply management program where farmers would have the confidence that they would be paid the cost of production plus a bit of a profit.
That concludes the first segment of this debate. When we come back, the candidates will have an opportunity to ask each other questions. This is the U.S. House debate on VPR and Vermont PBS.
Vermonters are listening closely to the candidates for office as they decide how to cast their votes in November.
This month, VPR and Vermont PBS are working together on election polls that will take the pulse of the state's voters about what Vermonters think about the candidates and their stances on key issues. Stay tuned to VPR and Vermont PBS next week for the results from our newest poll.
And throughout October, VPR and Vermont PBS are teaming up to bring you debates between the leading candidates for top offices.
Together, we're broadcasting live debates leading up to the general election on November 6th. Still to come in the series, debates between the candidates for governor and U.S. Senate.
Vermont PBS and Vermont Public Radio are both committed to keeping you informed as you make decisions about how to cast your ballot in November.
Listen to VPR and watch Vermont PBS for all of our public media team election coverage.
This is the VPR Vermont PBS U.S. House Debate on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're live in VPR Stetson Studio One today, and joining us are the two major party candidates for Vermont's seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, Republican challenger Anya Tino of Charleston and incumbent Democrat Peter Welch of Norwich. The candidates will now have an opportunity to ask each other questions. Questions need to be 30 seconds or less. Responses can be a minute, and we will allow a brief follow-up question and answer if you'd like. And just keep in mind, questions should be questions, not your own policy speeches. So we'll start with Peter Welch. Would you like to ask a question of Anya Tino?
Sure. Thank you. We both share a concern about Vermont dairy. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges is ethanol. And ethanol is bad for our small engines and our chainsaws. It's bad for the environment, in my view. But it also increases the cost of grain to our Vermont dairy farmers. The president recently decided to increase ethanol mandate from E10 to E15. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with President Trump?
For summer gas, yes. I agree that ethanol is bad. It has hurt the dairy industry, and I think that we need to move away from corn being fuel and move it back into the food production. I'm sure he had his reasons for doing that, but on ethanol, no. I agree that it's not the best way of going.
Well, his reasons, I think, were to prop up Iowa corn.
The Corn Belt does benefit from it, definitely. But that's an unfortunate thing at this point that it has gone in that direction. We're going to have to look at how we can correct that, but I'm not a proponent of ethanol.
So do you oppose the president's increase of the mandate to 15% in the summertime?
I think that if I was going to oppose it, I would have to look at all the reasons first.
Okay, I oppose it, yeah.
Anya Tinio, question for Peter Welch.
You said that you voted against the first farm bill because it had the all the wrong proponents in your mind. Why did you oppose the second one, the one that passed?
We haven't passed a farm bill yet.
The one that passed the House. The second one passed the House and not the Senate.
Both farm bills have the same defects in the House. Mm-hmm. The Senate, by the way, has a bipartisan bill that I would support. Mm-hmm. But the House bill, number one, took $23 billion out of the nutrition programs that are really important for our kids. And, you know, the stock market's up, unemployment's down, but child poverty is up. And this is not a time to take meals off the table for kids that need it and disabled people and our veterans. Number two, it started reversing the progress we made with supporting organic agriculture. Mm-hmm. It started reversing the support we made with putting money into energy efficiency and conservation efforts. So it was a real rollback of the support that had been provided in previous farm bills on a bipartisan basis. Now, the Senate has a bipartisan approach where we maintain most of those things I just described. So if we can get together, House Democrats and a few Republicans, along with Senate Democrats and Republicans, we'd be able to pass a farm bill.
Any follow-up question?
Yes. It does have a lot of conservation efforts placed in that, as well as the milk protection. And not having that bill pass is detrimental to both of those things. So I think that it's important for us to work towards a better bill, but also to have perhaps an interim bill placed to make sure that these programs continue.
Well, Senator Leahy, by the way, in the Omnibus Budget Act, he actually anticipated this problem, and he put in a status quo so that the milk protection program has actually been somewhat improved, and it lasts a year. So we've got some time, and dairy farmers are benefiting by that provision that Senator Leahy got in that omnibus bill, and I support it. Now, when we talk about the farmers, the farm bill is not going to deal with the real fundamental challenge they have of getting a price that's way too low. It's below their cost mm-hmm. of production. And that's what we've got to tackle. And that is going to take, I think, a supply management program.
So for the past 12 years, you've been in Congress, and they have been the senators, Patrick Leahy and Bernie Sanders, and yet the dairy industry is not better off than it once was. Why should they believe that you will still be the answer to their problems?
Well, I'm not saying I'm the answer to the problems. I'm an advocate for a solution that would include supply management. And I'd say two things. Number one, when I was in the state Senate, I worked with Senator Bobby Starr from the kingdom.
I know Bobby.
And yeah, he's a wonderful man. Yeah. And he and Francis Horgan, the then farmer, advocated for the Northeast Dairy Compact, and it provided that supply management program. Second, I work with Bill Rowell, who was a great advocate and created support around the country for supply management when John Boehner was the speaker, and we came very close to getting it, but Speaker Boehner called that Soviet-style agriculture, and we failed. So we've got to come together.
So you are a proponent of subsidizing farming?
Supply management is not necessarily subsidizing.
It's a version.
What you're doing, well, it really isn't. You know, if Apple Computer is selling a lot of iPhones, they ramp up production. Mm-hmm. If sales are going down, they reduce production. The problem that farmers face is that when the price goes down, the only way they can try to make up the difference in revenue
flood the market.
Is flood the market. Mm-hmm. And then the price goes down further. So how do you manage that? And there's a public good. It's not just for the individual farmers. We've got to have farmers who are doing local agriculture so that when we need our food, they're there to provide it.
We're going to stop that there, but we will be talking about the Farm Bill and more farm and dairy issues coming up on Vermont Edition. And I appreciate this education that you both have been giving us here on this issue. But
happy to do it.
Do you have another question for Anya Tinio?
You know, one of the things about President Trump that I frankly do find disturbing is the language he uses to describe other people or political opponents. He uses very derogatory terms about women. He's had a Muslim ban. He's had a policy of separating children from their parents at the border. And do you find this disturbing? I find it to be very unhelpful. We've got to bring people together, not accentuate differences.
I will say, as a woman, I've never been offended by President Trump's language. I think that definitely people use language that is regrettable in some instances and should be toned down. President Trump is not a politician. and I don't claim to speak for him, but I mean, he's rough around the edges. He's a businessman from New York City. I think we all understand that a little bit. I think that the rhetoric and the divisiveness started long before President Trump, and it was how he built his support base in order to have people get behind him. They wanted to know that there was somebody that was going to be a fighter, and he showed them right off the bat that I'm going to be a fighter for you. So it's unfortunate that our politics has degraded downhill to the point where this is necessary, but I think that it has become the norm, and we need to turn that around.
I want to keep us on track time-wise. So, Anya Tino, mm-hmm. do you have a question for Peter Welch?
Sure. What is it that you would like to see happen for the state of Vermont in the next 2 years that you haven't been able to accomplish in the past terms?
Well, first of all, I think I've done a lot on behalf of the state of Vermont. I mentioned Irene, opioid funding that we were able to secure and get millions of dollars to our first responders, the energy efficiency efforts that I've made, and also becoming a person in Congress who has a reputation of working with Republicans as much as I can. And it comes out of the tradition we've had here in Vermont when I was in the State House and the Senate president appointed Republicans, including Governor Scott, to chair committees. But I think the big issue for us right now is preserving our democracy. I think the guardrails of democracy are under assault. When I see the president attacking the press, attacking the rule of law, being too cozy, in my view, with dictators and authoritarians, I think that's very dangerous.
What about the erosion of our Constitution in this country?
I think President Trump is doing a lot of damage to the Constitution.
I think he supports the Constitution.
Well, I think you're talking probably about gun rights, but I got to say...
Talking about everything in general.
Well, I'll respond to that. Mm-hmm. I think the Constitution protects the freedom of the press, and I think the president is attacking it. I think the Constitution protects is embedded on the rule of law, and I think that President Trump is showing a continuing disregard. So I share your commitment to the Constitution, and a lot of us as citizens will have debates and discussions about what's the right interpretation. Mm-hmm. I get that. But I'm very alarmed by what I see, by the behavior of this president and his disregard, in my view, for the rule of law and the freedom of the press.
Peter Welch, another question for Anya Tino.
Well, I want to go back to immigration. You mentioned that the Dreamers should have got on with the process of applying for citizenship. And I disagree. I think you've got the facts wrong on this. Because a Dreamer, in order to do the citizenship request, would have to leave this country and go to a country they have no connection with. So let me just take Juan Conde, who's the UVM medical student. He's in medical school. He was brought here at 8 years old by his mom. He'd have to leave here and go to Mexico, which he doesn't remember, and then apply. Now, that's not a realistic option.
If I recall correctly, there was an option place where they could come and apply without leaving the country. I may be recalling wrong, but I believe that I'm recalling correctly. And if
they were required to leave the country, do you still support that policy, that that's what they should have done, comply with the policy, leave the U.S. and reapply?
They had a two-year window, and I don't believe that leaving was what they were asking them to do. However, if that is the law in place, they needed to start looking for a way to adhere to the law and perhaps petition for time.
No, see, I really don't get that, because we can have a debate about what's the right border security, a wall or other mm-hmm. barriers, but the Dreamers are not responsible for even coming here. They did nothing wrong.
Oh, I agree. And their parents are the ones that brought them.
That's correct. And the way it's working right now, those folks have no legal status here. They can be arrested. They can be arrested and deported, and some of them have been. And why do we do that? We don't have to. And that is just what I think is a really radical agenda on the part of the president, where the immigration issue is much more a political issue for him than it is an effort to try to get a solution. But that's my view.
What's your view?
I think that there is a political component to the immigration issue, but fundamentally we do need to correct the problems. And we need to look at how we can address this issue mm-hmm. as quickly as possible. And there has been a lot of bipartisan divisiveness on this issue that needs to be set aside so that we can come up with comprehensive reform.
Final question for Peter Welch.
You talk a lot about bipartisanship and working with Republicans, but you've been very critical of the president and other Republicans throughout the past 2 years, for sure. Do you feel that that is somehow benefiting the country or just dividing us further?
Well, I call it as I see it, much like you said you would. And I think I am critical of President Trump, and for very specific reasons. And
do you agree that the economy is better since he has been president?
For some people, it is better.
It's unfortunate that it hasn't hit Vermont yet.
And that's right. I mean, here's who it's not hit. It hasn't hit the middle class. I mean, what's happening is we have a divide in this country, and it's been going on for the past 20 years. And it's a huge challenge for our country, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. We obviously should be working on it together. But what you're seeing is that folks who are on the new economy side are doing well. If you're wealthy, you're doing well, because that stock market increase has done really well for people who own stock. But as you know, a lot of middle-income folks are just hanging on by their fingernails because the costs are going up. Prescription drugs, health care, cost of college education for their kids. Those are brutal price increases, yet their wages are stagnant and declining. And we even see that in Vermont. You know, Chittenden County is doing real well, but a lot of parts of rural Vermont are not doing well. And we need a federal government that acknowledges that and just plunges in to help restore rural America.
That's the reason I'm running.
Middle-income families.
Well, I will say that the middle class has been affected because I consider myself middle class.
Right.
And I am better off today than I was 2 years ago.
Good.
Financially. So I think that it has, in some ways, benefited Vermont's middle class, even if it hasn't been the complete spectrum.
Do you agree?
Thank you. No, the unemployment's down. We're way better off than when we went over the cliff. You know, my second term in Congress was the financial collapse, and we were losing hundreds of thousands of jobs a month, and we're now on the longest expansion in job creation from the Obama administration and through the Trump years to this point. So that's all good. But when you're around, and I know you know this, talking to people who are working hard, but their paychecks aren't rising, we've got to address that, because the core value of our country has always been an expanding middle class. And I meet so many parents who are apprehensive that their kids are going to be worse off, not better off, than they are.
That went fast. My favorite part of the debate, though. This concludes the second segment of our program. And when we come back, the candidates will answer questions submitted by Vermonters. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is the U.S. House Debate live on VPR and Vermont PBS.
This month, VPR and Vermont PBS are teaming up to bring you live debates leading up to Election Day.
Today, we continue our debate series with the two major party candidates for the U.S. House of Representatives. In the next 2 weeks, we're also hosting debates between the leading candidates for U.S. Senate and for governor.
Listen on Vermont Public Radio and watch live on Vermont PBS.
Throughout the debates, the candidates will answer questions from Vermonters. Suggest your debate question by email. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net. That's vermontedition@vpr.net.
Our debate series is just one way that VPR and Vermont PBS are keeping you informed.
Next week, we'll release the results of the newest VPR Vermont PBS poll with fresh insights into what Vermonters are thinking about the issues and the candidates in this election.
Stay with VPR and Vermont PBS this election season for thorough coverage from two trusted public media organizations.
This is the VPR Vermont PBS U.S. House Debate on Vermont Edition. With us today are the two major party candidates for the position, the incumbent, Democrat Peter Welch, and Republican challenger Anya Tino. And it's time now for some questions from constituents. I want to thank everybody who submitted questions to us. So, candidates, please limit your answers to these to 60 seconds, and we hope to have some time for a lightning round if we are able to stick to time. So, our first question comes from Anne in Middlebury. Anne writes, given the recent UN warning on the dire steps needed to avoid catastrophic changes to human life on Earth caused by climate change, what do you think Vermont and the federal government should be doing to prepare Vermont, and especially its dairy industry, for the necessary economic changes? Anya Tino?
Her question is about the 12-year tipping point, am I understanding?
What do you think Vermont should be doing to prepare the dairy industry specifically, but Vermont and the federal government for climate change, and what needs to be done, steps that need to be taken to prevent a catastrophic rise in temperature?
I think that the dairy industry is probably not the biggest contributor to climate change as people seem to think. There is difficulty with runoff and things like that that is always being addressed through U.S. Farm Bureau, USDA, all of those things. They are not the main cause of catastrophic rise in temperature, and I think the farmers are unjustly vilified as being an environmental hazard when, in fact, they are one of the best stewards of the land possible.
Do you think there need to be steps taken to deal with climate change and to try to pull back on?
I think that climate change is something that we can all work on towards bettering this. And I do not think that we need to spend billions of dollars in a Paris Climate Accord to achieve that. We can put all of these measures in place without that being the case.
Peter Welch, the question, the specific question from Anne is about preparing the dairy industry.
Well, every industry is affected by climate change. I mean, it changes the growing season. So maple producers are getting hammered with the changing season. The UN report said what we all know, and that is climate change is an immediate, urgent threat to the planet. And we have to act. And we've got a president right now who basically is a denier that climate change exists. It's like he's sitting in his kitchen, the roof is leaking, and he denies it's raining. So what we have to do is have an all-hands-on-deck approach to addressing climate change. We have to move aggressively from a carbon-based energy economy to a green energy economy. We have to start investing in renewables. We have to be investing in energy efficiency. And this is not about spending billions of dollars. It's about investing in our future. But the other thing that is so important to understand is that if we challenge this problem and face it, we can create jobs. I mean, the technology that's coming on board, that's being created by companies, by the way, that aren't having an argument with scientists about whether it exists or doesn't, but are coming up with new technologies, that's creating good jobs and more wealth. So we can actually strengthen our economy as opposed to imperil it if we plunge in.
Sounds like both of you have an all-in approach to dealing with global warming and climate change. Margaret wrote in to say, what are the specific concrete steps that you will take to reach across the aisle and work with people from the other party? Peter Welch.
Well, number one, virtually all the important legislation that I've gotten passed has been with a partner, like pediatric cancer research, like Irene funding. Eric Cantor was very helpful. But second, this issue in Congress is really serious. It's broken, and it's because power has been consolidated in the Speaker's office and not in the committees. And I'm working with a group, bipartisan, called the Problem Solvers, 24 Republicans, 24 Democrats, and we're advocating for changes in how we do our business. We want bipartisan bills to be fast-tracked for consideration. We want the minority party, whether that's us on the Democratic side or the Republicans, to have an opportunity to have an amendment as opposed to a closed rule, as it's called. We want to guarantee that the committees that do pass a bill with bipartisan support have that bill brought to the floor for a vote. Like, for instance, this past year, there were a lot of Republicans who supported giving Dreamers legal status that I support. We weren't allowed a vote on the floor. So these process reforms are more than about process. It's about having that institution work to meet the responsibilities that we have.
Anya Tino, what about for you? What are some specific concrete steps that you would take to reach across the aisle and work with the other party?
I am a staunch conservative, but I am open-minded. So I would take a common sense approach to everything. If something makes sense and it comes from a Democrat, I'm not going to say I won't do that just because he's a Democrat or she's a Democrat. I think that we can work together, and I think there's more that unites us than divides us, and that if we put aside so much hate and anger, we can achieve better results together. And I would be very willing to reach across the aisle and see who would be willing to work with me. And I think that we would do well.
Is there a specific topic that you can think of that you would be trying to introduce legislation on that you would work with a Democrat on, or a specific piece of legislation that you've already seen in the House that you would say, yeah, I'd sign on with a Democrat on that? Because Margaret's looking for specific concrete steps.
I would look to try and do something to combat child trafficking and child abuse and all of those things. And I think that the Democratic Party would be happy to join me on that.
In fact, there's been a bipartisan bill on that.
It needs to continue.
All right.
Yemen has been in a brutal civil war for more than 3 years, with Saudi and Iran lined up in coalitions that have been battling over the country. Now the UN says that 12 million people could face famine if the fighting doesn't stop. Chris in Middlebury says, "We feel the suffering of our brothers and sisters in Yemen. What can Congress do to help to stand up for the families in Yemen?" Anya Tino?
I think that there's always humanitarian aid that is going into these situations, and currently it's difficult to get it to the places that it needs to be. We may have to look at some form of military action to put an end to this. Whenever Iran is involved in anything, I question the motives. I think the Islamic State is definitely part of it as well. And we need to be very cautious about allowing that region to fall into a radical realm, such as what happened in Syria. So humanitarian crisis needs to be addressed, and food is definitely a big part of that, but it's also medicine, it's also shelter, and I think that, as I said, the aid workers are doing their best to get it there. We may just have to figure out a different way of going about it.
Peter Welch?
Well, we definitely have to figure a different way of going about it, because what we're doing essentially is we're being complicit with the Saudis, who are causing all the suffering. I mean, the Saudis are bombing indiscriminately, and that's what the UN report says. They're bombing women and children, and they're using starvation as a political tactic. We're arming the Saudis. They're using our weapons to inflict this suffering. And we have leverage by pulling back on the weapons or by using the relationship that the president has with the Saudis. So that's number one. What we're doing is assisting the Saudis in what is a brutal assault on a civilian population. Number two, the aid workers can't get in there. I mean, that's the problem. The aid workers are brave people from all countries, and they'd show up if they could get there. But there's essentially a blockade there. And this suffering is immense. And then as far as a military solution, I do have to say I really disagree with you on that. I mean, the military engagements we've had, like in Iraq, it's been a disaster. And the president said that before he was president. And if we're going to use military action, then Congress has to have a vote on it. We have to use an authorization for the use of military force, not just cede that to the executive. So I oppose that.
What would military action look like to you, Anya Tino? What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that when people are in danger of being annihilated, you have to look at all options on the table. And if a military option is one of them, Congress, of course, would vote on it. And that may be the necessary step to take, whether we can rein in the Saudis and the Iranians without that option is yet to be seen.
Joan has a question for you about Washington politics. Joan says, what is the most important thing Vermonters need to be aware of about Washington, D.C. politics, and how could our votes help? Peter Welch?
Well, I think Vermonters are aware of Washington politics. It's broken right now, and that's, Congress is not popular for good reason. But the Constitution created the House of Representatives, and we have to act. And not acting just means that bad problems get worse. So Vermonters, I think, are really actively engaged. I hear from them all of the time. I travel around the state constantly. And what I'm hearing from Vermonters more than anything else is they're apprehensive that the guardrails of democracy are coming down. In fact, I was at a rally last week in central Vermont, and a former Marine, 6 years of service, he said, "Peter, I'm with you and a lot of others on all the issues like climate change and health care and getting our economy going. But," he says, "the big thing we're fighting for is to preserve our democracy." That's the feeling I'm hearing from Vermonters, and I think that's true.
So we have time for a little bit of a lightning round here. Anya Tino, you get an answer first, though, about Washington politics.
Yes. The answer I would give is that Vermonters are aware of politics in Washington, and they are afraid that democracy is being broken down, as Mr. Welch was saying. I've heard that almost everywhere I've been, that they're concerned about their constitutional rights. They're concerned that the divisiveness in Washington is actually harming the country. I share those concerns. I think that we do need to turn that around, and I think that it begins at home here in Vermont. We need to take time to consider all options and to work towards it. And their vote does count, because who they send to the House of Representatives will be their voice in Washington, and it's my goal to be their voice.
Okay, so let's talk lightning round. And we're looking for, you know, pretty short answers so we can get in as many of these as possible.
Sure.
So, you know, 10 seconds, something like that. Who is one foreign leader you respect and why? Anya Tino?
Present or in the past?
Your choice. You get to pick. Okay. Preferably not imaginary, but otherwise, up to you.
Okay. I would say that a foreign leader that I would have to respect is Winston Churchill. He stood up against the evil of Nazism, and he led his country with strength and poise and grace. And at times, people wondered if England would even survive. But they did, and he was a strong leader, and he brought comfort to the people in times of trouble and strife, and I think that he's an excellent example of what we should be able to do.
Peter Welch?
Well, I agree with Anya on Winston Churchill, but to be different in my answer, Angela Merkel. She's an extraordinary leader in a very difficult time, in a very difficult place, and she's got resolve, she's got character, she's got strength of her convictions, and I'm a big admirer.
This one can be answered with a simple yes or no. Should marijuana be legalized at the federal level? Peter Welch?
State level.
Not federal.
No, we should have at the federal level, we should respect the decisions that states make. But I think that debate is best held in the state.
Anya Tino?
No federal level. I agree that it's a state issue.
What's your favorite Vermont product? Anya Tino?
Well, it's easy to say maple syrup, but I will have to go with real whole milk with cream. I love dairy fat. That's my biggest vice. I love dairy fat.
Peter Welch.
Well, we're finding areas of agreement here, but I'm going to say maple because I put it on everything. I'm like Homer Simpson when it comes to maple.
Well, maple and milk together would be a pretty good thing. Yeah. All right, so time now for closing statements from each candidate. And we actually determined the order via private coin flip before the show started. We did this yesterday. And Representative Welch, you have the honor of starting us off. Final thoughts.
Well, thank you. You know, these are tough times in this country. And people are really anxious about whether the basic core democratic principles are now being challenged. And I think they are. And I want to continue doing this job because I think Vermonters, in the way we do business with our town meeting tradition, our tradition of listening to people, our understanding that consensus and compromise are really important, I want to do my best to continue my efforts to bring that to Washington. Second, I want us to have an economy and economic principles that focus on the challenges that the middle class face. And there's enormous anxiety among many people that their kids are not going to be as well off as they are. And parents are willing to sacrifice for their kids, but we've got to have policies where they don't graduate with a mountain of debt, where they have an opportunity to get job training. And third, we really do have to have a willingness to tackle some of the major problems like climate change that are being neglected. So I hope that I'll have the opportunity to serve Vermont again. Thank you.
Anya Tino, final statement from you.
First of all, thank you for having us. Thank you, Congressman, for being here today.
Thank you.
This is a vote about liberty. We must stand up for our constitutional rights, for our freedom, and for the future for our children. We need to bring jobs to our state to strengthen our agricultural community and defend our Constitution, and I will work to achieve all of those. I believe in my heart that America is best when we are strong together and when we focus on the principles that made us this great country in the beginning. I will be a defender for all of that, and I will be your voice in Washington. I appreciate your vote on November 6th, and I'm open to comments and concerns of the constituents, so you're always welcome to send them to me, and I don't guarantee a quick answer, but I will get back to you. It's been a pleasure to be here. It's been my honor to run, and I look forward to serving you in Washington.
Well, that's the end of our U.S. House debate here on Vermont Edition. I want to thank our participating candidates, Anya Tino and Peter Welch. Thanks very much to both of you for participating today.
Thank you, Anya. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can find all of VPR's campaign coverage, including interviews with all of the candidates on the ballot for statewide and federal office, at our website, vpr.net. The VPR Vermont PBS debate series is produced by Sam Gale Rosen, Patty Daniels, Keith Swan, Brian Stevenson, and Matthew Smith. We have production support from Michelle Owens, Anna Post, Ty Robertson, and Anna St. Marie. Audio engineering by Chris Albertine, Frank Alwine, Mary Engish, and Peter Engish. Our music is by Eric Ewazen and the New Trombone Collective. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for joining us.